This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Where does your energy come from? Will you be able to afford gasoline 10 years from now? How about heating oil or electricity from coal? No doubt you've heard we've reached peak oil a few years ago. We can't produce more, even though the rest of the world is buying cars, plastics, and all the wonders of fossil fuel-based lifestyles. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Back on November 6, 2009, I interviewed Richard Heinberg about his book Blackout. Heinberg says even coal resources have been puffed up beyond reality. Instead of the 100-year supply promised, we'll run out of coal this century. It's time we all learned the facts of life for the fuels we depend on. Fortunately, we have a great teacher in David Hughes. He's the geoscientist who prepared high-level government reports on energy for the Geological Survey of Canada. Now he's on a mission to inform the public with his speech known simply as The Talk. I'm going to play you talk number 182, recorded in Toronto at Transition Toronto Conference, February 3, 2011. We have already broadcast Dave's forecast for natural gas and our May 20th Radio EcoShock show titled Fracking Myths. Now you get the lowdown on the two other biggies, oil and coal. David Hughes is not an entertainer. It's a serious talk, patiently unraveling the lies we've been told. He gives us the best estimates of how much time before we run out of the lifeblood of today's civilization. I recommend recording this talk if you can, or download this program later as a free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org. Why? Whether you are a communicator or just a citizen trying to map out the map of survival, Hughes packs in all the facts you need to think, to talk over with locals and on the net, to write, plan, and act. Drink it in, learn it, pass it around, because the mainstream media, powered by car ads and drunk on fossil fuels, is never going to tell you what you hear today. I have one serious disagreement with Dave. He's a scientist steeped in geology who concludes that peak oil, in fact, peak fossil fuels, is the big issue humans need to face quickly. Based on a single study by a Caltech professor named David Rutledge, David Hughes will tell you climate change is not such a big worry. Rutledge is not a climate scientist or even a geologist. He's a specialist in electronics and radio. But he caused a stir in 2007 by saying the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was using the standard optimistic figures for energy supply. Even if we burned all available fossil fuels, Rutledge claimed, the atmosphere couldn't go above 450 parts per million carbon dioxide, below the most optimistic level predicted by the IPCC. It seems to say we couldn't really kill the climate because there aren't enough fossil fuels to do it. Rutledge raises a good point. The IPCC shouldn't rely on wildly optimistic energy forecasts from the International Energy Agency or the American government. But he leaves too much out to be considered seriously, in my opinion. Things like carbon feedback as the great forest burn, now happening in the Amazon and the boreal forests and in the southern part of the United States. They are converting from carbon sinks to carbon sources. With enough warming, the ocean will also release more carbon. As far as I can tell, Rutledge doesn't count the methane releases from the warming Arctic or the frozen methane released from warming seas, the clathrates. The whole feedback process from nature is left out in the simplified linear view of just humans burning fossil fuels. If there are peer-reviewed papers by climate scientists on Rutledge work, I haven't seen them. So Dave Hughes and I will have to disagree on whether peak oil or climate change should be our priority. But it doesn't matter. Both are happening too fast for us to comprehend. Both are impacting our lives right now. And fortunately, both peak fossil fuels and climate change share many of the same solutions, like sustainable energy, solar and wind, geothermal, and other safe non-carbon sources. To cover Dave's talk, we are going to leap right in with his review of energy forecasts and then his overview of the real supplies of oil we have left. In the second half of the program, we'll hear Dave Hughes cover the big daddy of dirty energy, King Coal. From Transition Toronto, here is David Hughes with the non-stop facts of life in a fossil-driven society.
In 2009, fossil fuels were 84% of the world's energy consumption. Oil, number one, followed by coal and natural gas. Most of the balance is large hydro and nuclear. And if you look at non-hydro renewables, they're basically a thin line. Forecasts of the future. There's two principal groups in the world that make long-term energy forecasts, the Energy Information Administration in Washington, and the International Energy Agency in Paris. This is the EIA forecast, reference case 46% growth in energy consumption by 2035. If we look at that reference case forecast by economic development, we can see that the industrialized world, the OECD countries, consumed roughly half of the oil, or half of the total energy, in 2009, but consists of only 18% of the world's population. The developing world, the non-OECD countries, is forecast to grow by 75% by 2035. And the developing world is over 80% of the world's population. If you look at the forecast by fuel, coal is forecast to be the fastest growing fuel source in terms of hydrocarbons up until 2035, followed by natural gas and oil. Nuclear will grow in real terms but decline in market share, according to this forecast. Hydro and true renewables will almost double, but are still a relatively small proportion of total energy consumption. I usually say, if you remember two slides out of this lecture, remember this one and the next one. This is world per capita energy consumption by fuel, 1850 to 2009. In 1850, wood, renewable biomass was 82% of energy consumption, 18% coal. In 2009, the average citizen of the world was consuming the same amount of renewable energy per capita as in 1850. The problem is the average citizen was consuming more than eight times as much energy, 89% of which was non-renewable, coal, oil, gas, and uranium. People think of coal as a 19th century fuel, but in fact, coal was the fuel of the 20th century. The average citizen today consumes as much coal per capita as in 1910. The consumption of oil really took off after World War II, and oil did not replace coal. Oil added to the per capita consumption of energy. Natural gas added still further, and uranium added further still. Next slide you should remember, and this is the energy sustainability dilemma personified. If we look at global population compared to 1850, there's 5.4 times as many people in the world. Each person is consuming 8.5 times as much energy. The world is consuming 45 times as much energy as in 1850, 89% of which is non-renewable. And all of these forms of non-renewable energy are likely to have a peak in production in the first half of this century. If you remember three words from this lecture, remember these three. Beware of scale. The 84% of primary energy provided by hydrocarbons is a lot of energy. Less than 2% of primary energy consumption is now provided by non-hydro power renewables. There are no scalable alternatives to hydrocarbons at the rates of energy throughput we enjoy at this point in time. Unconventional hydrocarbons, things like tar sands and Venezuela extra heavy oil, are very difficult to scale. They require a lot of capital, a lot of infrastructure, and a lot of time to grow production. There's certainly no panacea for the decline of conventional crude. And this is what I mean when I say beware of scale. 2009, primary energy consumption by fuel. If we look at non-hydropower renewables over the last few decades, we can see a huge growth in geothermal, solar, and an exponential growth in wind. If you add up the contribution of those forms of renewables to 2009 primary energy consumption, they're less than 0.5% of the total. So beware of scale when you talk about getting off of fossil fuels. In summary, hydrocarbons, 84% of the world's primary energy in 2009. The forecast suggests that that won't change out until 2035 at least, when fossil fuels are forecast to be 80% of consumption. Most of the balance of energy supply will be provided by large hydro and nuclear sources with their own environmental problems. The questions are, in my mind going forward, is this forecast achievable? And what are the implications for security and energy sustainability going forward? To answer those questions, I'd like to look in more detail at oil, gas, and coal. If we look at oil, number one source of energy in the world, 35% of primary consumption in 2009. The ultimate fuel for international trade. It's easy to move oil around the world by tanker and pipeline. The Achilles heel of oil is geopolitics. The OPEC cartel controls about three-quarters of what's left of the world's oil. Alternatives to oil have seen similar price volatility over the last several years. Natural gas, coal, and uranium. A rather compelling chart for me. This is the cumulative consumption of oil. We got started with the first well at Oil Springs in southwestern Ontario in 1858. And by year end 2009, we consumed a little over 1.1 trillion barrels of oil. Depending on whose ultimate recoverable resources you use, that's somewhere between a third and a half of all the oil humans will ever consume. What strikes me about this diagram is 90% of all the oil has been consumed since 1960, 50% since 1987, 10% since 2005. We're now consuming 31 billion barrels of oil per year, and it's been a long time since we discovered an oil field with 31 billion barrels in it. If we look at global oil production and consumption by geopolitics, we can see that the OPEC cartel produced 43% of the world's oil in 2009, but consumed only 10% of it. The non-OPEC world outside of the former Soviet Union peaked in 2002, produced 41% of the world's oil, but consumed 85% of it in 2009. The only growth outside of OPEC is in the former Soviet Union, produced 16% of the world's oil and consumed only 5% in 2009. If we look at oil production, net exports, and net imports from these three regional areas, we can see, first of all, that the former Soviet Union's oil production collapsed when the Soviet Union broke up in the early 90s. It's come back big time. The former Soviet Union exports roughly the same amount of oil as Saudi Arabia, 70% of its production. OPEC exports about three-quarters of its production. One of the characteristics of OPEC countries is their demographics are quite young, and they highly subsidize domestic consumption of things like gasoline. So domestic consumption of oil in OPEC countries is growing rapidly at the expense of their ability to export oil. Non-OPEC countries outside of the former Soviet Union imported 53% of their consumption in 2009. If we look at world oil reserves, we can see in 2009, roughly three-quarters of the world's oil was controlled by OPEC, 14% by non-OPEC, 9% by the former Soviet Union. If we look a little closer at six OPEC countries that control two-thirds of the world's oil, these are reported reserves, 1980 to 2009. First of all, we can see a major ramp-up in reported reserves at the end of the 80s. At the time that OPEC changed the way they set their production quotas to be based on reported reserves, and lo and behold, reported reserves went up by nearly 300 billion barrels without significant new discoveries. Over this 30-year period, reported reserves have gone up by over half a trillion barrels, 138% increase. These countries also produced 219 billion barrels of oil over this period. Saudi Arabia's reported reserves have been flatlined since the late 80s at about 240 billion barrels. The Saudis produced 92 billion barrels over this period. Their reserves never went down. Hugo Chavez decided he would double Venezuela's reserves back in 2008. It's interesting also that all of these six countries have peaked in the past. Venezuela, 1970, Iran, 1974, UAE, 2006, Kuwait, 72, Iraq, 1979, and even the Saudis are producing below their 2005 peak. I'll mention this again in this talk. Reported reserves are less important than deliverability and flow rates, the ability to produce that oil into the global oil market. Many geologists would suggest that a portion of these reserves are political and not geological. Forecasted future oil production, this is the EIA again, reference case forecast 27% increase by 2035. That reference case translates to a 36-year reserve life. If we include 143 billion barrels of undeveloped tar sands, that would serve to extend the reserve life by about 3 years to 39 years. The IEA in Paris has become much more pessimistic on future oil production in the world. This is their latest World Energy Outlook published in November. The so-called 450 scenario is what world oil production would look like to keep CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere at 450 ppm max. Their new policy scenario assumes some fairly stringent carbon policies in the world. And this scenario calls for a 14% increase in global oil production by 2035. If we look at that scenario as to where the oil is coming from or the liquids are coming from, the IEA is suggesting that global conventional oil peaked in 2006, and it can maintain on a plateau out to 2035 by developing new fields that we've discovered but haven't developed yet, and developing fields that are yet to be discovered. All of the growth in liquids is forecast to come from natural gas liquids and from unconventional oil, things like biofuels, tar sands, Venezuela extra heavy, and so forth. A very compelling chart by Colin Campbell. The green bars are the amount of oil discovered in each year. World oil discoveries peaked in 1965. The black line, the amount of oil consumed. And since roughly 1984, the world has been consuming more oil than it's been discovering in each year, to the point where we're now consuming 3 to 4 barrels of oil for every barrel that we're finding.
If you have just tuned in, this is Radio EcoShock. We're listening to a survey of our energy supplies from Canadian geoscientist David Hughes. David prepared high-level reports until he retired from the Geological Survey of Canada. He's a board member of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas Canada and a fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute. Back to the talk.
Peak oil, world oil production peak. When will it happen? Debatable. Because of the variables, it's really only a question of when, not if. It depends on ultimate recoverable reserves, how much is there, a function of technology, price, and it depends on rate of consumption, which is also a function of price, production infrastructure, and the depletion rates of producing pools. There's been a lot of peaking that's gone on in the world already, and these are all of the countries in the world that have experienced a peak in production in the past, arranged chronologically from when they peaked, and the length of the bar is the percentage they're producing below peak production. The U.S. was first, peaked in 1970, producing at 37% below peak. The U.K. peaked in 1999, 50% below peak. Norway, 2001, 30% below peak. Denmark, 2004. Mexico peaked in 2004. It's now 20% below peak. These red countries are OPEC countries that are past peak. I mentioned Venezuela, Libya, Kuwait. Moving forward, Nigeria peaked in 2005, 18% below peak. Angola, 2008. And you could argue that with enough investment, some of these countries could grow oil production past their previous peak. The point is that 30 of these countries peaked since 1995, 23 since 2000. 76% of 2009 production was from countries that are past peak. I could have put the Saudis on this list, peaked in 2005, but I didn't, because they assure us they have enough spare production capacity to grow well beyond their 2005 peak. Many forecasts have been made of when world oil will peak. This is one of the more pessimistic ones by Colin Campbell. He suggests world oil peaked in 2008, excluding biofuels. Biofuels could push the peak plateau out a little bit further. One thing is very clear. The cheap oil is on this side of peak. Large pools, easy to find, cheap to produce. The expensive oil is on the downslope of this curve. Difficult to find, small pools, hard to extract. The EIA in Washington has their own view of peak oil. Their P50 estimate of ultimate recoverable for the world is a little over 3 trillion barrels. We've used a little over 1.1. That would leave a little over half a trillion barrels left to find in the world. The EIA suggests the world can grow oil production until it hits a 10-year reserve to production ratio, at which point oil production would collapse. If that were possible, the world would peak in 2044 at 84% ultimate recoverable produced. Most geologists suggest that peak will occur at or before 50% of ultimate recoverable is produced. If we have 3 trillion barrels ultimate, that would occur in 2018 at half consumed. Nonetheless, the EIA cuts their forecast off in 2035, so you can't see the implications of their peak oil scenario. This is the reference case scenario of the EIA. You can download it from their website. I just like to point out unconventional oil. If we can quadruple unconventional oil, it's still a relatively small part of forecast demand by 2035. Many geologists suggest the world will never get past about 90 million barrels a day. We're 86 at present, and that production peak could occur in the 2012 to 2015 timeframe. This is the last decade of world oil production. It includes data up until October 2010. And in essence, the world has been on a production plateau since early 2005. This yellow is surplus production capacity in the world. 80% of it is in Saudi Arabia. This is where we would have to get to meet the 2035 EIA reference case forecast. And the EIA, and to a certain extent the IEA, would say, well, it's just a matter of investment. If we invest enough $1 trillion in upstream oil and gas, we can continue to grow production. An interesting study out of the UK Energy Research Center, this was published in late 2009. I've added a few forecasts of my own here. I've color-coded these into green, no worries forecast. The world can continue growing production until 2030 at least. Included in the optimists are OPEC, ExxonMobil, the EIA, and a couple of the forecasts of the IEA, and Shell's best case scenario. The yellow forecasts are peaking before 2030, followed by a shallow decline. Oil companies like Total are quite pessimistic. Peak 2020 at 95 million barrels per day. Shell's low case peaking at 90 million barrels per day in 2020. A few of the other ones, more pessimistic ones, are generally academics. An interesting one by Chris Skrybowski, suggesting a peak in about 2012. And Skrybowski maintains a database of all the mega projects in the world that are coming on stream, when they'll come on stream, and what their production levels will be when they come on stream. It takes about 6 years from discovery to bringing a mega project online. And a mega project is defined as being more than 100,000 barrels per day. Skrybowski's, the other issue is depletion. And the IEA did a study of 800 of the world's biggest oil fields and published that in 2008 and concluded that of the older fields, the average depletion rate is about 6.7% per year. So including some of the newer fields, if we consider depletion about 5% per year, we have to overcome about 4 million barrels per day of depletion to keep production flat with new mega projects. And if demand grows, we have to come up with still more mega projects to meet that demand growth. Skrybowski's mega project database indicates that there's enough projects coming on stream to meet depletion up until about 2013. Beyond that point, there's a big deficit in terms of new production. President Bush, I think 3 years ago, in his State of the Union address, said America is addicted to oil. Nothing could be truer. In 2009, the U.S. imported 61% of its consumption. So the U.S. imports significantly more oil than China burns in total, with four times the population. It's interesting to note what the Great Recession did to oil consumption in the U.S. It knocked it down by about 1.5 million barrels per day. Canada, a net exporter of about 1 million barrels per day, number one provider to the U.S., Mexico, a huge growth in production. But as I mentioned, Mexico peaked in 2004. Some people are suggesting that Mexico will not be an oil exporter after about 2014. North American oil reserve to production ratio at current production rates. The U.S., 11 years. Canada, including 26 billion barrels under development in the tar sands, about 28 years. Mexico, 11. North America as a whole, 15 years. Canada is a story more and more about oil sands in terms of oil production. 2008, 44% of our production was from the oil sands. People talk about Canada being the number one exporter to the U.S. They rarely talk about imports of oil into Canada. And most of eastern Canada is dependent on imports purchased on the world market, more than double since 1986. Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers forecast for Canadian oil production. This assumes all of the existing projects that are already online and all of the projects under construction come online. And that really puts Canada on an oil production plateau, peaking at around 2015 at around 3 million barrels per day. In order for Canada to significantly grow oil production, there has to be a lot of new projects announced in the oil sands. Unconventional liquids, all of them, biofuels more than triple, oil sands more than triple, Venezuela extra heavy oil more than double, coal to liquids up by a factor of 7, expansion of gas to liquids and even some shale oil. If all that happens, unconventional liquids could be 11.7% of forecast 2035 world demand. Significant, yes, but no panacea to offset declines from peak oil. The concept of net energy is a very important concept in talking about liquids production. In the good old days in Saudi Arabia, there was a fabulous net energy profit. The amount of energy used to drill the wells, connect the pipelines, build the pipelines, compared to the energy that came from the oil that was produced. We're now drilling 20,000-foot horizontal wells in 5,000 feet of water, 3D seismic, subsalt drilling off the coast of Brazil, much more energy intensive, net energy maybe 25 to 1, mineable tar sands about 6 to 1, but mineable tar sands are only 20% of what's there. In situ tar sands, the 80% of what's there are about 3 to 1. Ethanol from corn, about 1.3 to 1, so we burn a barrel to net out 3/10 of a barrel. Ethanol from sugarcane is much more net energy positive. So as we go down the food chain from high-quality oil reservoirs, where we can extract a large proportion at a net energy profit, down to things like oil shale, where people have really never extracted oil shale at a net energy profit, these big in situ numbers are meaningless. The only number that counts is the amount that we can get out at a net energy profit. So it's really not a resource issue, it's a deliverability issue, a flow rate issue. It's difficult to grow flow out of deposits like oil sands or oil shale, even though the in-situ resource may be very large. So it's not about running out of oil. It's about hitting the wall in terms of our ability to grow production. I mentioned that the IEA has become much more pessimistic on oil production. Fatty Birol is the chief economist of the IEA, and he said this in The Independent in 2009. Even if demand remained steady, the world would have to find the equivalent of 4 Saudi Arabias to maintain production and 6 Saudi Arabias if it is to keep up with the expected increase in demand between now and 2030. It's a big challenge in terms of the geology, in terms of the investment, and in terms of the geopolitics. Some of the better peak oil studies are done by various military establishments. This is one by the U.S. Joint Forces Command, published in 2010, in which they stated, by 2012, surplus oil production capacity could entirely disappear, and as early as 2015, the shortfall in output could reach nearly 10 million barrels per day. Very pessimistic outlook. A German military study leaked in July 2010, entitled Peak Oil, Security Implications of Resource Scarcity. They recognized the correlation between GDP growth and growth in consumption of energy. The energy supply must be sufficient to allow positive economic growth. A shrinking economy over an indeterminate period presents a highly unstable situation which inevitably leads to system collapse. The risk to security posed by such a development cannot even be estimated. A report released a couple weeks ago by the UK All-Party Parliamentary Group on peak oil. Regrettably, the government is still unable to grasp how serious the threat of peak oil is, and so the UK remains inadequately prepared to cope with this looming crisis.
That ends the Facts of Life talk from David Hughes on oil. In the original speech at Transition Toronto on February 3, 2011, Dave went on to stick a pin in the growing myths about natural gas and fracking. We ran that on Radio EcoShock in our show May 20th. Download that program as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. When we return, Dave takes us deep into the coal mines of the world to blow up another myth. No, we don't have enough coal to keep this society going, even if we don't mind wrecking the climate. As we continue, the Facts on Coal with David Hughes.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. You've been told we have enough coal to last hundreds of years. Really? Not according to author Richard Heinberg in his book Blackout. The blackout is what happens when we run out of fossil fuels with no same-scale replacement in sight, with no plan B. What are the facts? You have come to the right place. David Hughes is our geoscientist, an expert for the Canadian government for 30-something years. Now in retirement, he's part of the Association for Study of Peak Oil and Gas Canada. David has been touring, giving his constantly updated speech about energy resources. This is The Talk from February 2, 2011, as Dave Hughes takes on black coal.
If we look at coal, roughly half of what's left of the world's hydrocarbon energy. Number two, second only to oil, roughly 29% of primary consumption in 2009. used for electricity generation more so than any other fuel. Lowest cost heat source. Achilles heel of coal, of course, is carbon footprint. Unless you believe the full cycle emissions work of Howarth at Cornell. Nonetheless, coal, because it's cheap, is the fastest growing hydrocarbon fuel source globally. Coal consumption has grown 45% since year-end 2002. Cumulative consumption of coal. We've consumed more energy in terms of coal than we have in terms of oil because we've been consuming it for a longer period of time. 90% of all the coal has been consumed since 1911, half since 1974, and 10% since 2004. Production and consumption of coal in the world is a story about the Asia-Pacific. Huge growth in both production and consumption of coal in China, 3 billion tons a year. North America is a big producer and consumer of coal, about 1 billion tons a year in the U.S. Forecast for the future, coal is forecast to be the fastest growing hydrocarbon fuel source out to 2035, 54% growth, and that translates into a 67-year reserve life. If you turn hydrocarbons into energy content, coal is a little over half of what's left of the world's hydrocarbon energy. If we look at the distribution of hydrocarbon energy regionally, we can see that the Asia-Pacific and North America are Saudi Arabia's of coal, as is the former Soviet Union. On a cost per unit of heat basis, oil is very expensive, about triple the price of domestic natural gas for heat. We can put coal on a ship and move it anywhere in the world for less cost than the natural gas. And some of the mine-mouth coal-fired power plants in Alberta are amongst the cheapest fuel source on the planet on a heat basis. Coal was once considered a fuel for centuries or thousands of years. There's been several studies published since 2007 which are projecting a peak in global coal production, which could occur as early as 2020, 2030. This is one study by Energy Watch Group suggesting a peak in coal production in 2025 and a peak in China earlier in 2020. Another forecast out of Uppsala in Sweden, global peak in 2030. A study out of Newcastle in Australia. They had three scenarios. Their most conservative scenario was a peak in 2010, about now, with an ultimate recoverable of 700 billion tons. Their median case was a peak in 2034, if ultimate recoverable was 1,144 billion tons. A very compelling study for me out of Caltech, using a technique called Hubbert linearization to look at the amount of recoverable coal available. And this basically looks at cumulative coal production from year zero through time and projects to the point where annual production doesn't change anymore, which means all of the coal has been recovered. Caltech is suggesting an ultimate recoverable of 680 billion tons, which is about the same as a conservative case from the Newcastle study. Caltech did the same thing for world oil and gas combined, and this is what their production scenario would look like. And this assumes we produce the coal as fast as we can and the other hydrocarbons. Peak coal 2022, peak combined oil and gas 2019, global peak of all hydrocarbons 2020. If we look at that on a percentage remaining basis through time, when I was born in 1950, 95% of recoverable hydrocarbons remain to be extracted. Today, we've extracted about 42% of remaining recoverable. By 2017, we'll have extracted 50%. 2050, 80%, 2100, 98%. That's a fairly serious concern for future generations. I mentioned there's nothing like hydrocarbons in terms of a dense, versatile, useful form of energy. And in fact, we'll need hydrocarbons to build the alternative infrastructure for whatever comes next. For example, windmills. A 2-megawatt windmill has 260 tons of steel in it that took 170 tons of coking coal and 300 tons of iron ore to make, all mined and transported with hydrocarbons. Caltech looked at how much carbon could we actually get in the atmosphere if we burned all remaining recoverable hydrocarbons as fast as they could be produced. And their conclusion was that we can't get to even the lowest IPCC scenario of hydrocarbon in the atmosphere. The IPCC has 40 different scenarios of carbon in the atmosphere going forward. And that would suggest that of the two problems, energy sustainability and climate change, energy sustainability should be our first focus. And the good thing is, a lot of the things that people have proposed for climate change also serve to address the energy sustainability dilemma. The reason the IPCC scenarios are so high is because they basically assume there is essentially unlimited recoverable hydrocarbons. This is their maximum number out to 2100. It's not even ultimate. 7 times Caltech's ultimate recoverable oil and gas, 8 times Caltech's ultimate recoverable coal. In terms of atmospheric CO2 concentration, Caltech estimated that we can get to the 450 ppm danger threshold of James Hansen's just, and that would occur in about 2062 and translate to a global temperature rise of about 1.12 degrees C, suggesting there's not enough recoverable hydrocarbons to get close to the 2-degree danger threshold of Hansen and the IPCC. If we look at electricity, it really defines a first world country. It can't be stored in bulk. It has to be generated on demand. We convert hydrocarbons to electricity at an energy penalty depending on the fuel and the technology. It's not a continental commodity. It's a regional commodity because of transmission losses with distance. The forecast for electricity generation in the world, China more than triple by 2035, India more than double, the rest of the developing world nearly double. The OECD will grow more slowly, and the developing world will be generating 61% of the world's electricity by 2035 in this scenario. Generation by fuel, coal is forecast to be the number one source of fuel for electricity going forward. It's expected to maintain and slightly grow market share. Natural gas, maintain market share. Nuclear, maintain market share. Large hydro, maintain market share. But if we can grow non-hydro renewables by more than a factor of 5, they could be as much as 7% of forecast generation by 2035. If we look at the makeup of non-hydro renewables, wind would have to grow by 8 times when it would be about 4% of generation. Biomass, nearly by 4 times. If we grow solar PV and concentrated solar by 27 times by 2035, it will still make up less than 0.5% of generation. So beware of scale. U.S. generation by fuel. Again, coal, number one source of fuel. However, it will lose market share going forward. Natural gas maintains market share. Nuclear grows slightly, but loses market share. Large hydro basically maintains market share. And non-hydro renewables, again, if we can grow them by more than a factor of 5, they could be as much as 11% of forecast generation. U.S. non-hydro renewables, a close-up wind, grows by more than a factor of 6, 4.2% of 2035 generation. Biomass and all other renewables are the most important source. And of those would include things like tidal and so forth. Biomass is by far the most important. Again, solar PV and concentrated solar. We grow them by 25 times. They're still less than 0.5% of forecast generation. If we look at wind in the U.S., there's been a huge build-out of wind in terms of nameplate capacity, in particular in the last decade. And I've looked at the availability of wind. One of the problems with wind is it's intermittent. It has to be backed up by a reliable, dispatchable form of energy. And this is the availability of all of that wind capacity over a 2-year period. It averages about 31%. So there's issues when it comes to renewables. What about clean coal? Some people would say it's an oxymoron. How clean is clean? The best technologies are about 25% more efficient than old technologies. Much better in terms of the cleanup of particulates, SOx, NOx, and mercury. The most efficient current technology is ultra-supercritical coal, 43.5% efficient compared to less than 34% for the old coal fleet. Denmark is a world leader in coal, in wind. Roughly 20% of Denmark's generation is wind. 50% is coal. They're a world leader in coal. They use the best technology, ultra-supercritical plants located in industrial settings where they can capture and use the waste heat that comes out of coal plants. It's called district heating, combined heat and power. If you can capture most of the waste heat out of a coal plant and use it to displace hydrocarbons that would otherwise be used to generate that heat, the overall efficiency of a coal plant can go up to 70% or better. So by being smart about how you use coal, the CO2 footprint can be halved, as Denmark has done. Obviously, if we burn coal, we have to do it in the smartest way possible. Carbon capture and storage, a scalable clean coal solution. It's been bought into in a big way by the Harper government. Stelmac has put up $2 billion for carbon capture and storage in Alberta. In my opinion, it's unlikely. I say that because of energy waste, parasitic power loss to capture CO2, compress it to a liquid form, move it in a pipeline, is about 30% of the energy in a coal plant. It's expensive. The capital cost is roughly 50% higher than a normal coal plant. Time to build. There's no full-scale examples of a coal plant with carbon capture and storage in the world at present. To scale that to anything meaningful will take decades. Complexity. Now we have to administer the equipment on the plant, the pipelines, the injection wells. In my mind, this is a vast expenditure of capital that represents a lost opportunity. That capital could be much better spent on infrastructure to radically lower our energy consumption throughput. What about nuclear? I won't talk about the waste issues and the capital cost issues and the other issues with nuclear. I'll just look at the fuel issue and at the fact that most of the installed base of nuclear capacity in the world is old. It was built back in the 70s and 80s with a 40-year life. A lot of those plants are getting old. They have to either be repowered or decommissioned and replaced with new plants. To keep nuclear capacity in the world flat going forward, we need 283 new reactors in the world by 2030. So we need to be commissioning about 12 new reactors per year just to replace retirements. To keep capacity flat, we're not doing that. We're commissioning maybe 3 or 4 new plants per year. So no matter how you slice it, there's going to have to be a massive build-out of nuclear capacity going forward. The fuel issue, we have to go to new technology if we expect not to have a fuel problem with nuclear going forward. Once through light water reactors, we could be looking at a fuel problem as soon as 2070 if we ramp up capacity a bit. So the future of nuclear lies in fast breeder reactors, or possibly thorium reactors, if those can ever be successfully deployed.
We are listening to a speech by Dave Hughes with the truth about the supply of coal for North America and the world. This is Radio EcoShock. Many people, including your politicians, assume if oil runs out, well, we'll just burn coal. We could even convert that to gas. Keep all our cars running. Well, maybe not. Let's get back to Dave Hughes speaking to Transition Toronto.
The hydrogen economy, hopefully it's talked about less and less these days. Unfortunately, hydrogen is an energy carrier, not an energy source. 95% of the hydrogen in the world is made from steam reforming natural gas at present. We can make it with electricity. If we do so from either source, we lose 30% of the energy in the electricity or in the natural gas. So the question is, why not just burn those sources directly? If we make hydrogen from fossil fuels, obviously, we make the greenhouse gas problem worse because of the energy loss and conversion. There's been lots of good studies on other issues with hydrogen, storage distribution, fuel cell cost, and longevity. A comparison of different ways to store energy, energy density by weight, energy density by volume. Batteries are the worst way to store energy, followed by compressed hydrogen gas. Liquid hydrogen is better, but we have to keep it at minus 253 degrees centigrade. There's nothing that can compare to the energy density and versatility of things like gasoline, diesel fuel, and propane. The last piece of the puzzle is the whole issue of population growth. and the aspirations of growth in consumption in the developing world in particular. If we look around the world, there's a great inequity in terms of per capita consumption of energy. Canada is at the top of the food chain. Canadians consume 6 times the world average, 7 times China, and 29 times India. The problem being is 3/4 of the world's population has a per capita energy consumption lower than the world average. 1/4 of the population has a per capita consumption higher than the world average. These people aspire to first world levels of energy throughput. If we look at China, for example, history and forecast in terms of population, per capita consumption and total consumption, China is forecast to have over 1.4 billion people by 2030. Per capita consumption is forecast to grow by 77%, total consumption nearly double, up by 92%. If we look at production and consumption of energy in China over the last 3 decades, first of all, we can see that it's growing exponentially. The green is coal, which is the reason that China has such a high CO2 footprint. Coal took a hit in the late 90s with the so-called Asian economic flu. Consumption of oil didn't really show any signs of declining through that economic downturn. Consumption of energy in China grew by 8.5% in 2009, almost the same as their GDP grew. Again, the correlation between GDP and energy is very high. China imported 10% of its energy requirements in 2009. Oil into China. China was a net oil exporter up until 1993. In 2009, 56% of China's oil was imported. So in 2009, 6% of world oil consumption was now imported into China in competition with all of the other people that import oil. India does not have a population control policy. India will be the most populous country in the world by 2030. Per capita consumption up 42%, total consumption up 80%. Oil into India, 3/4 of India's oil consumption was imported in 2009. So now 3% of world consumption of oil is imports into India. The rest of developing Asia, nearly 1.4 billion people by 2030, forecast consumption up by 82%. Oil into the rest of developing Asia, 54% of requirements were imported in 2009. If we put developed and industrialized countries on the same vertical axis, this is total energy consumption. Today, the U.S. is the number one consumer of energy in the world. China is forecast to be the number one consumer by 2014. Per capita consumption of energy in the world, history and forecast. It's interesting to note that Canadians consume 3 times the energy per capita of industrialized Europe. We have a lot to learn from Europe in terms of lowering our energy footprint. CO2 emissions. China became the biggest emitter of CO2 in the world about 3 years ago because of all of the coal that they use. On a per capita basis, China is about equal to the world average. Canada and the U.S. are close to 4 times the world average in terms of per capita CO2 emissions. And yet we're asking for big concessions out of the developing world at Copenhagen and Cancun. Global population forecast to reach more than 9.5 billion people by 2050. We're now adding about 75 million people per year to the planet. If we look at cars on the same vertical axis, there's 1 billion motor vehicles in the world. 1/4 of those are in the U.S., only 70 million in China. China is the number one motor vehicle market in the world today. Roughly 16 to 18 million new cars being sold in China each year. 62 million motor vehicles built in 2009, close to the number of net people added to the planet. Food, there's a question of how we feed all of those people. And this is different strategies for getting food and the net energy that they require. We use a lot of hydrocarbons for things like nitrogen, which really is responsible for the Green Revolution, pesticides, antibiotics, and so forth. Strategies like feedlot beef are very energy-intensive ways to get food about 15 units of energy in per unit out, distant fishing, very inefficient, range-fed beef, efficient coastal fishing, very efficient. The trajectory of the U.S. food system has gone from about 1 to 1 in 1910 to about 10 to 1 at present, the hydrocarbons we eat. The UN Food Commodity Price Index is highly correlated to the price of oil. We saw a peak back in mid-2008 when the price of oil hit $147 a barrel. And Jeff just told me at dinner that we're now above this previous peak, now that oil is in the low 90s a barrel. Lifetime consumption of the average American. We use a lot of commodities other than energy, nearly 1,200 pounds of copper, 500,000 pounds of coal, 1.37 million pounds of stone, sand, and gravel, all mined and transported by hydrocarbons. So if we return to the dilemma, 5.4 times as many people as in 1850, each person consuming 8.5 times as much energy per capita, a world that consumes 45 times as much energy as in 1850, 89% of it non-renewable. If you believe the forecast that I've been showing you out of the EIA, the reference case, 46% growth in energy consumption by 2035, this is what the world will look like in 2035. 6.8 times as many people as in 1850, each person consuming 9.6 times as much energy, a world that consumes 65 times as much energy as in 1850, 89% non-renewable. And I hope you'll agree with me, now that we've looked at the production scenarios going forward, that this forecast is utterly unachievable. Now, why do they do it? Why do they keep making these projections that the future will look like the past without ignoring some of the obvious constraints of natural limits of the planet? And I kind of dug around, and really our economic paradigm is based on continuous growth. And that's basically dogma of our present-day economic thinking. And some economists that have a fair amount of sway in the White House have made absolutely outrageous statements, in my view. For example, Julian Simon wrote a book called The Ultimate Resource. The human mind, technology, was capable of solving any problem. There would always be an alternative. He made this statement: we have in our hands now the technology to feed, clothe, and supply energy to an ever-growing population for the next 7 billion years. You know, according to a study of body lice, people haven't even been wearing clothes since roughly 170,000 years ago. The Earth is only 5 billion years old. That's quite a statement. Economist Larry Summers, president of Harvard for 6 years, director of Obama's National Economic Council up until the 1st of January. He made a statement when he was the chief economist of the World Bank. There are no limits to the carrying capacity of the Earth in the foreseeable future. The idea that we should put limits on growth because of some natural limit is a profound error. And it's astounding to me that these people have a lot of sway. And I really do think that this kind of thinking is behind the kind of projections that we see out of governments, in particular the EIA. Julian Simon has legions of detractors, one of whom is Kenneth Boulding. Anyone who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. The term sustainable growth is an oxymoron. And Albert Bartlett has given 1,600 lectures on exponential growth. He's an emeritus scientist at the University of Colorado Boulder. So just to summarize, the energy sustainability dilemma will be the defining issue of our time as the economic growth paradigm abuts physical limits to growth. Although Canada is likely to be able to meet domestic energy requirements from internal sources through 2030, it will not be exempt from the economic fallout of global energy resource limitations. Oil is a globally priced commodity. GDP growth is linked to energy consumption growth. There's no possible way that Canada can escape. The climate change dialogue, for the most part, excludes any consideration of resource limitations on growth, and hence leads us down some counterproductive pathways. And I would put carbon capture and storage as at the top of the list. Although initiatives on conservation, efficiency, and renewables fortuitously also address the energy question. Hydrocarbons represent an extremely convenient, dense form of non-renewable energy for which there are no scalable alternatives. They will be needed for the development of infrastructure for the next paradigm of more sustainable human development. A sustainable energy future is not out of reach, but will be hugely challenging. Several Manhattan projects, we best get on with them. Back in 2005, Jared Diamond wrote an excellent book, in my view, called Collapse, and he studied societies that had succeeded and failed in the past, the Mayans, the Ticapians, the Easter Islanders, and so forth. And he concluded his book with a statement that I thought was very apropos for our time. A lower-impact society is the most impossible scenario for our future, except for all other conceivable scenarios. Thank you very much.
That was geoscientist Dave Hughes giving his famous roaming talk on peak energy. This recording was courtesy of Transition Toronto, recorded February 3, 2011. My thanks to Dave Hughes for permission to broadcast it. Maybe you noticed this was one of the most dense, fact-filled talks I've ever put on radio. I recommend you download this show as a free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org and listen again. Personally, I took a lot of notes by stopping and starting the audio. My notes are like a little booklet, courtesy of Dave. Those facts help orient me, help me plan my future, help me communicate on radio, and with friends and community. The next time someone pops up with energy optimism or denial, you can have the cold hard facts from this talk. This speech also makes a good starter for your next transition or energy meeting. Make a few copies and get the word out there. We might as well have a few well-informed citizens. The government and the media are never going to tell you what you heard on this show. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for being serious enough to listen to a heavy-duty speech. We need to know, and this is how we find out. From Boston, this is Evan Greer with Even If the End Is Near.
View from our front porch changes every day. They stack bricks on top of concrete and they haul the rest away. And we wake up every morning to the sounds of their machines. I think I might go crazy without you lying next to me. I'm not ashamed of my sadness or my fear about where we are today or where we'll be in 50 years. But it's you who gives me hope, who keeps me sane, who keeps me clear on why we should keep doing what we do, even if the end is near. Sometimes the sunsets somewhat terrify me. They're beautiful and they're colorful, but they're not the way they used to be. When the scariest statistics are racing through my head, at least I know when I get home you'll tie me to the bed. And I'll forget all about hopelessness and feel hopelessly in love. For an instant I'll remember every dream I've ever had. 'Cause it's not escape, it's ecstasy. It's never felt so right to me. I have so much more hope now that there's someone here to fight with me. What the end has in store will be no match for you and I. We're not afraid to be afraid or to break down and cry. And we might be overwhelmed, but we won't be immobilized. Together, I think we could touch this world before we die. I'm not ashamed of my sadness or my fear about where we are today or where we'll be in 50 years. But it's you who gives me hope. You keep me sane, you keep me clear.